Press, it's supposed to appear in a special edition of the Journal for Art and Aesthetics and Art Criticism. So, any of your feedback would be very helpful. Okay? Don Rickles, the so-called merchant of Venice, turns to Ronald Reagan during a roast and says the following: "You're a politician. Black, white, Jew, Gentile. We're all working for one cause: to figure out how you became governor." Rickles is known as a democratic distributor of insult. He kept them coming regardless of his target's age, race, gender, or nationality. For instance, during a roast of Lucille Ball, Rickles turns to Nipsey Russell and said, so, remember, you know Lucille Ball and Nipsey Russell. Lucille Ball, have you ever seen the show, I'm a Booster? Nipsey Russell, African-American comedian. I don't know what to point you to. The main point is African-American, right? So keep that in mind. So Rickles turns, during the roast of Lucille Ball, Rickles turns to Nipsey Russell and says, "Shut up. I hate it when a spade butts in." Now spade, if you're not familiar, is a racial slur for black people, okay? So most of Rickles' names, four black people on stage, play heavily on well-tried stereotypes about laziness or subservience. In this case, Rickles plays on a racial slur to achieve comedic effect. Did he go too far? What are the rules of a comedic roast? Initially, there might seem to be a tension between the comedic and roasting or insult. The comedic roast is a form that traffics in mean-spirited jazz. Consider comedian Nikki Glaser's joke about Ann Coulter during a roast of Rob Lowe. "The only person you will ever make at me is the Mexican who did your drink." The comedic is often concerned with the funny, lighthearted mirth or fun, while insults are mean-spirited in nature, tools of injury. So how can these two seemingly contrary elements be combined to produce something fun? What follows, I first evaluate a few possible explanations for the resolution of this apparent tension. I then propose an alternative, one that suggests when roasts succeed, they do so by employing mechanisms that redirect one's attention to aspects besides the joke's content. It is when the mechanisms fail that roasting becomes disagreeable. Okay. Implicit in the title are two lines of questioning. One pertains to the rules of the roast. That is how one ought to conduct oneself when attempting to produce mirth from insult. This is to place the emphasis on roasting in the phrase roasting ethics. Another, however, presents the topic of ethics as the object, that is to emphasize the ethics in roasting ethics. I will have much more to say about the first line than the second, but the concluding section, if I have time, will offer some brief suggestive considerations about the second line. Right, so why do we even have practices of insult? for the most part, I'm giving this talking to U.S. audiences. Invariably, there is a non-U.S. Person or persons in the crowd. And they say, well, it's not entirely clear that that's a practice that is familiar and questionable. Right? So my partner's from Austria. They didn't have this practice there. As I understand it, British humor is supposed to be somewhat dark and biting, but I don't know that we characterize, I don't know if we have an extant practice of roasting it per se. But I take it that insult is sort of a crucial part of British humor. So you will be able to track. So why do we even have practices of insult here? I suppose there are different options of explanation available for such questions. I won't delve deeply into all of them, but we'll make sure to talk. One reason we seem to have practices for insult humor is to promote solidarity among a particular group. This is a function Peter Kibbe and Scott Patrick Murphy both highlight. According to Kibbe, humor serves a dual function of establishing solidarity among any group and identifying those who belong to the out-group. Drawing from Ted Coleman, Kibbe notes that humor functions to bring people together while holding on to Thomas Hobbes' claim that it is also a means of aggression. Though Kibbe discusses humor in general, I think it applies to insult humor as a specific form as well. Alternatively, insult humor can also be used to emphasize the first term in that compound phrase, insult. Not all uses of humor are meant to elicit mirth, at least not indiscriminately. Sometimes the target of a vicious insulting joke is an object of vilification. In situations such as these, if there is fun to be had, the object is not typically meant to be included in it. They are treated as a means or a mere means to others' mirth. Lastly, there seem to be instances of insult humor that serve another purpose. That is, the object of ridicule is not necessarily the individuals or groups presented as the butt of the joke, but something broader or more abstract. There may be occasions when the intended object of a roast is something like abstract ethical principles, norms, or broad social attitudes about certain topics. On these occasions, the roaster deliberately violates the assumed norms, perhaps as a way of questioning their status as sacred or untouchable. Roasts also occur in a wide range of contexts, both formal and informal, friendly and hostile. They occur among friends and acquaintances as rituals for bonding, as well as in highly structured contexts like comedy clubs and special events. The differences in context might yield differences in operative rules. Providing a characterization of the potential differences in rules between different contexts is a worthwhile project. I will not focus on that characterization here, however, but will narrow my considerations to the way roasts operate in structured contexts like clubs. As I stated in the introduction, there is a prima facie tension between what I call the comic and insult. Before elaborating on the notion of insult, I first want to say a little bit about how I'm thinking of the comic. There are several theories of humor that attempt to explain what the philosopher Noel Carroll refers to as comic amusement, which is the state one is in when one finds something funny. That is a pleasurable state, often marked by the presence of a smile, or laughter in the one experiencing it. I remark that the comic is often concerned with lighthearted mirth or fun. But, of course, people utilize humor to engage with a wide array of topics and situations. For instance, gallows humor takes as a central topic the event of death. This is a subject not commonly associated with lightheartedness. So the practices various communities develop around menacing subjects like death suggest that we look for ways to lessen the force of things that pose great stress or pain, at least temporarily. In these situations, the comic starts to look like a break to things that are grave or serious. The sense of the comic is exemplified by the sociologist and theologian Peter Berger. Quote, "In ordinary, everyday life, then, the comic typically appears as an intrusion. It intrudes, very often unexpectedly, into other sectors of reality. These other sectors are colloquially referred to as serious. By implication, then, the comic is unserious." Borrowing from the account of Austrian philosopher Alfred Schütz, Berger refers to sectors or spheres, essentially worlds of experience that human beings move between. The primary or most consistently inhabited sphere is the everyday or common life. Humor is also represented as a sphere with its own logical rules. Berger states that it intrudes on the everyday. He intimates that this intrusion of the comic takes us away from the rules operating in the sphere of common life, perhaps causing us to suspend certain beliefs and attitudes that would normally cause us to react to certain utterances and events in different ways. Michael Gelvin notes that in antique Roman and medieval Christian literatures, we find moral censures against laughter, the rationale being that it undermines gravitas and reveals either a satanic realm or decadence. This further reinforces the association often assumed between the comic and unseriousness. Thus, the suggestion, at least for present purposes, is that the comic represents a break from the seriousness of everyday reality. Okay. Now, the Oxford English Dictionary tells an origin story about the word insult, that has the noun form deriving from a 17th century French term, insult, denoting an attack. There's also a medical use of the term, referring to anything that tends to cause disease or bodily injury. According to Jerome Liu, insult is about humiliation and the assertion of superiority, the assertion or assumption of dominance. A number of people have seen the relationship between comedy and tragedy. Consider the following from literary critic Walter Kerr. Comedy, it seems, is never the gaiety of things. It is the groan made gay. Laughter is not man's first impulse. He cries first. Comedy always comes second, late after the fact, and in spite of it, or because of it. Comedy is really the underside of things. After the rock of our hearts has been lifted, with effort and only temporarily, it appears in the absence of something, and as the absence of something. Man's primary concern is with the rock, with his heart, with tragedy. For Kerr, the jovial and sorrowful masks represented in the theater are two sides of the same coin, or rather, the same face, worn by the same man, reporting the same event. If this is so, then it wouldn't be surprising that pleasure can come from man. In order to get a start on an account, let us look at an account of insult presented by Newton. On his account, to insult is to assert personal dominance, either intentionally claiming superiority or unintentionally revealing lack of regard. News characterization provides a much more explicit account of the content expressed by insult. Insults assert dominance, at least in many instances. Now, stating things this broadly is certainly too promiscuous, since there are plenty of assertions of dominance that are not interpreted as insults. So, I have an NBA example. I don't know English football all that well. I'm just going to mix it up and then you tell me if I got it right. But I guess, assuming that Manchester United is superior to Liverpool, is that a question? This is on the fly. You're stating sort of factual dominance by one team during a decade. That's sort of a straight ahead, you know, expression of fact, even if it stings the, say, fan of Liverpool. You shouldn't be ready for this. Alright. New does know that insult typically involves shock, a disruption of expectations. He claims that insult is a kind of injury that concerns the expectations of attention and respect. Typically, we have expectations about how we should be treated or regarded. The kinds of expectations we may have will vary depending on the person or people involved in a particular context. The occasion was taken over. Taking these remarks about expectations and the assertion or assuming of dominance together, the picture that emerges about insult is one in which certain assumptions or assertions undermine purportedly reasonable or justifiable expectations of the insulted to be treated or regarded in certain ways. Thus, one is insulted when treated in a way that undermines reasonable expectations for respectful engagement. The addition of expectations as a component provides a way of distinguishing assertions of dominance, that insult, from those that merely report a true thing. Now, given the characterization of insult as the undermining of expectations for being treated with respect, how can we make sense of their use in comedic contexts? If the aforementioned connection between tragedy and comedy can at least assuage the apparent tension, then one might consider whether insults are transformed in some way within comedic contexts. A good place to start is by suggesting that the speech act typically performed with insults is not so performed in a roast. As we saw earlier, insults are sometimes perceived as an attack intended to injure a target. Presumably, roasts are not aimed at injuring a target. A different speech act is involved. Perhaps the linguistic mechanism undergirding speech acts in roasts is irony or sarcasm. One classical definition of irony is followed. Irony is the figure used to convey the opposite of what is said. In irony, the words are not taken in their basic literal sense. Grice's accounts of irony have also followed this art. Grice thought the irony deliberately flouts the maxim of truthfulness. That is, one ought to be truthful and not so say what you know to be false or unsupported, thus implicating the opposite of what was literally said. But this is how we understand irony. It's not clear it helps us describe what's going on in the world. This is because ironic utterances are employed to communicate some specific content, whereas roasts do not seem to be doing that. Communicating content just isn't a goal of the roast. The speaker is not really trying to get anyone to believe anything, or at least nothing more than the general idea that they are superior in wit, something like that. Now, there are other forms of irony that do not have this consequence. Wilson and Sperber, for instance, identified various cases that do not adhere with the traditional definition. One such case is the ironical understatement, illustrated by the following. See if you can detect the understatement of the statement. The underness of the statement. A single nuclear bomb could ruin your whole day. Gotcha? So obviously, a single nuclear bomb would be much more than ruin your day. Right? So there's a sense in which the speaker says less than what could be said. Next, Sperber and Wells said, identify the ironical interjection. This form is demonstrated by the utterance of, Tuscany. Uttered by someone who arrives to a cold, rainy Tuscany after being told there's no place more beautiful than that. For Wilson and Sperber, interjections do not express complete propositions, and so cannot be true or false. Nonetheless, they do sometimes appear to have ironic force. Finally, Wilson and Sperber put forward irony as a form of echoic utterance. An echoic utterance is a report of thought or speech that simultaneously expresses the speaker's attitude towards what his thought is said. So consider the following exchanges. Two players, Peter and Mary. First, Peter, the old songs are still the best. Mary, still the best. Second pair, I've been trying to work on my impression of this attitude for Mary. I haven't quite landed it yet, but tell me if you can. Peter, the old songs are still the best. Mary, still the best. That's what we can say. Mary indirectly reports Peter in both statements. The force of her utterance depends on the manner in which she utters it, captured by the parenthetically, finally, or contemptuously. Echoing acts as a distancing mechanism that creates a certain kind of space between Mary and the content that she utters. This is employed in Wilson and Sperber's definition of irony. The speaker echoes a thought she attributes to someone else while disassociating herself from it with anything from mild ridicule to savage scorn. Seems, however, that the speech act underlying roast is not represented by ironic understatements, interjections, or echoing and reporting, or at least not necessarily so. In fact, for many instances, the linguistic device most employed appears to be hyperbole. Hyperbolic statements, in the right settings, can have the effect of momentarily disarming one's critical stance. It can also affect how one comes to view or interpret an utterance. But even though insults may not be characterized by irony, there is something useful and instructive in considering. Just as with ironical statements, we are compelled to look for an alternative interpretation. Roasting speech acts similarly compel us in this direction. In the next section, I'll present a view that explains successful roast in terms of redirection. That is, the speaker aims to redirect our attention away from those content in a way that brings us to appreciate something else, perhaps something about the form of the utterance. Now, given the issue raised in the previous section, we are left with a pressing question. How to resolve the apparent tension between insults and mirth? This is the question we will aim to answer here. We can begin with a scenario that might seem intuitive to many, namely the tension is resolved once we realize the speaker does not mean any harm. It's just putting us on. It's noted, humor is often associated with non-seriousness. Thus, it is a reasonable first step to signal that one is being facetious with one's remarks. A successful roast occurs when the speaker successfully signals that a non-serious interpretive frame ought to be applied to the utterance. This is sometimes referred to as talking shit. Sticking with the nomenclature, I will refer to this as the talking shit view. Before we discuss the particulars of the talking shit view, I want to take a brief detour to elaborate on the idea of success. What constitutes a success for us? An answer to the question depends on how the notion of an audience is construed. In the professional setting, the roast is typically performed in front of a live audience. In fact, there are multiple audiences present. There is first the object of the roast, who's the honoree. Next, there are the other roasters on the dais. Additionally, there's the crowd seated at the venue. And finally, if the event is televised or recorded, there will be a viewing public not present at the live event and not confined by time in the way it applies to live and present audiences. This makes the roasting playwrights polyphonic, and seemingly makes the roaster responsible to multiple audiences. Thus, success becomes a complex and complicated thing. We can start with a simple proposal. Success in a roast means the production of mirth in one's audience. Obviously, the smaller the audience, the fewer the demands on successful performance. As one can imagine, things grow more complicated once the audiences start both growing and converging. For one thing, the object, the target of the roast, and the viewers of the performance plausibly have different satisfaction conditions. Presumably, being the target of insults is much more difficult than being a witness to them. Things that affect us directly, or are closer to doing so, tend to have more affective immediacy than things not aimed directly at us. This is right. It suggests that the roaster will need to appeal to the object of the roast in ways different from the audience in general. Since the insults are directed at the object, and hence more immediate, whereas this is not necessarily the case for those viewing the roast. Now, someone could suggest that it is possible for an audience member to be potentially subject to the immediacy of insult vicariously. Maybe the subject matter involved in the roast hits close to home for the member, or someone who is very close to them. I admit this is possible, but submit that what often makes roast most effective is drawing on material that is unique to the target. Specific details that are widely known about the particular object. In those instances, audience members are less likely to be caught up as in a dragnet, the way they typically are in non-roasting comedic routines, since the material for the latter is usually broad-scope tropes and situations rather than particularized material. Now, one of the tools that allow very skilled comedians to produce successful performances is improvisation. For many performers, interacting with a live audience aids and informs their performance. Seeing and hearing the audience's reaction in real time provides useful information the performer can use to evaluate the performance and make adjustments on the spot. Thus, for the skilled roaster, improvisation is a useful means of answering audience response. And once again, the multiplicity of audiences threatens to potentially deliver conflicting sets of input and different strategies of response. It's not inconceivable that insults directed at the object of a roast could make that person feel one way while the audience or some significant portion thereof feel another. You might be inclined to think that generally audiences' responses to roasts follows the object's response. That is, if the target laughs, the audience will laugh. This is not always the case, but it does appear to be a general tendency. As an instance of divergence in reaction between audience and target, recall President Obama's roasting of Donald Trump at the correspondence dinner. Trump's stony demeanor did not keep everyone else from laughing. Much more can be said about why that was the case, but the main point is that this example reflects the idea that the target's laughter is not necessary for audience laughter. Finally, that portion of the potential audience who views a roast via recording raises further questions. First, how responsible should we take the performer to be to this audience? If a roasting event were recorded but not released or made available to viewers for, say, a decade or two, would the performance's success be somehow contingent on this future audience's response? That is, what is the status of a performance's success if we take under consideration trans-historical evaluation? Whose taste should determine the success of a roasting performance? I'm sorry. There is also the issue of divergent taste among different audiences. And then the question then becomes, well, whose taste determines that the standard for evaluation, right? So I think these are interesting questions to ponder about the ruminations on in front of the day. Now, let me pause for a moment to consider the notion of a successive person. Let's now turn back to the topic shift. The view directs our attention to the purposes of performance being undertaken more than anything else. On this account, for instance, a reasonable reply to someone who was offended by what was said would be, I was just talking shit. Identification of the illocutionary force is thought to suffice for excusing any offense. Typically, a central factor in identifying force is speaker attention. Gryson accounts of speaker meaning, for example, involved the recognition by audience members certain intentions of the speaker. Thus, the speaker signals and the audience retrieves the speaker's intention that what is communicated is to be interpreted, not serious. The talking shit view offers a compelling explanation for what makes a roast successful. In essence, the view signals that the roaster is engaged in a kind of play. When the speaker is able to convincingly portray insulting utterances as playful, a mirthful response is typically the result. I still have a sense, however, that the view is incomplete. For instance, we do not yet have an explanation of how the signaling is communicated. Further, I trust there is the intuitive appeal of the notion that different people are just better at performing successful roasts than others. Or even that the same individual can experience different levels of success at different times. That is, there is a skill-based assessment associated with roasting. Thus, I believe the championship view will need to be augmented to account not just for the interpretive framing that accompanies insulting, but also for the mechanics of roasting as communicative behavior. There are other considerations of which we should keep track. First, intending not to insult or offend does not guarantee not doing so. And a person can find joking about certain matters inappropriate and insulting despite one's having an unambiguous, non-serious tone. In fact, what an audience may find insulting is that the speaker fails to handle the topic with the seriousness it is believed to deserve. Relatedly, there is a sense in which one can transgress a boundary many believe ought to be respected. There are limits and boundaries to what is fair game. Not just anything is up for grabs and roasts. For example, much of what Mariella Moskov, a writer for a publication, Romper, saw as problematic with the roasting of Ann Coulter during the Comedy Central roast for Rob Lowe was that many of the jokes focused on her looks and womanhood. Moskov argues this was lazy, that many of the jokes took aim at Coulter while needlessly dragging along others in the process. These are matters I will briefly engage with. Differently, but takes its inspiration from some things said about Don Rickles' routines mentioned earlier. Recall that Rickles was quite democratic in the way he doled out insults. No one was off limits. Targeting everyone and making it known that everyone's in the game perhaps puts the audience at ease. Not feeling subject to being especially singled out releases the tension between the comedic and insult. Call this the equal opportunity. Equal opportunity intimates that the price of being able to laugh at the roasting of others requires accepting their own subjection to it. It may be that recognizing one is not especially singled out allows for a relaxing of the customary interpretation of insults for something less threatening, even jovial. The reasoning might go something like the following. The speaker employs speech that typically gets interpreted as insulting. That speech is distributed in a fairly egalitarian way. So either the speaker is a misanthrope or doing something I should regard as non-threatening. Given other background evidence that the speaker is not a misanthrope, I should regard the evidence as non-threatening. You'll be surprised to know that I think this view is not entirely satisfactory. First, you can involve a tacit appeal to the claim of non-seriousness we saw in the talking shit. And as we saw there, non-seriousness is not sufficient for producing a successful roast. Second, the equal opportunity view assumes, but does not demonstrate, how we get from an insult to mirth. It basically says, look, everyone is a possible target, so it can't be taken as an insult. Equal opportunity leaves us without an explanation for how to turn insults into mirth. The last view I want to propose does not focus on the type of speech act being performed or the egalitarian nature of its distribution, Rather, it places emphasis on the manner in which these utterances perform. Typically, the more aggressive girls trade a material that, under normal circumstances, would be interpreted as hostile. For instance, during a roast of Bruce Willis, Jeff Ross, you know who Jeff Ross is, he's the so-called current roast master general. So if you ever watch the Comedy Central roasts, he's always the dude that goes last before the actual roast honor. I think he's bald now. White Jewish guy. Crucial detail, what I'm about to say. Jeff Ross remarks on comedian Little Rel Howard, who is an African American comedian, being in the movie Angry Birds 2, and comments that it's good to see Little Rel isn't selling out. Ross then asks, what do you play? Jim Crow? If you don't know Jim Crow, I'm just going to assume you know Jim Crow, okay? In more serious context, Ross's remark would likely be met with a program called out for being racist, or at least racially insensitive. The audience responded with laughter in this instance, however. How was he able to pull this off? Assuming they pulled off. The presentation of the material is done in a way that gets the audience to focus on the delivery rather than on the content of what's being delivered. That is, the audience's attention is redirected from the content of the utterance, some other feature of features. Let us call this the redirection. The clever nature of the delivery disarms the audience, causing them to revel in the perceived ineptness of attack, so that it gets taken up as not an attack at all. This is an important feature given what was said about the nature of insult in the previous section. If insult is perceived as a kind of attack, then the speaker must do something to ensure the audience that what is being presented is not actually harmful. That is, if the response intended is one of mirth rather than defense. One virtue of this view is that it provides a straightforward explanation but goes wrong where roast fails. When the speaker fails to shift the audience's attention away from the content into the manner of presentation, the content is highlighted and received as the attack it normally is under customary interpretation. A suspicion might arise that this view cannot account for occasions on which mirth is produced by a roast because of its content. That is, for some roasts, the insult is the point. In this instance, the roast produces mirth not despite but in virtue of its content. It is true that mirth has a variety of sources and that roast can succeed where success is characterized in terms of audience responsiveness for reasons other than distraction. For example, I suspect that many found President Obama's roast to Donald Trump at the 2011 White House Correspondents' Dinner a treat because they held animosity towards him and thought he deserved to be ridiculed. On this occasion, the mirth from a roast was due to the content and the perception that the target deserved ridicule. Now, one could try to resist the apparent implications for this, for the redirection view, by suggesting that Obama's utterances were not roast, strictly speaking, but satire. Since Trump is a public figure, and one who was widely recognized as the main proponent of the so-called Burka movement, he is an appropriate target of caustic joking. Even if this defense is found plausible in the particular case, it is clear it is a specific fix and not a general response. That is, there will be still cases in which mirth occurs and the utterance cannot be plausibly classified as satire. And the distinction between satire and roast here being assumed is one in which satire is some kind of often humorous form of social critique, where the object has certain kinds of satisfaction conditions. Right? The object has to be a public sort. There's a kind of relationship between satirizer and satirized object, such that when that object is, say, lesser in power, social status, it's no longer a satire, it's constantly bullying or something like that. Right? So there's a kind of punching up, punching down distinction that's involved and meeting out of appropriate satire, which is always supposed to be aimed at a subject who's in a higher social position. All right. Roast on explain the paradox of tragedy and upbeat. Hume writes, who can ever think of it as a good expedient for a comforting and afflicted parent to exaggerate with all the force of elocution the irreparable loss which he is met with by the death of a favorite child? The more power of imagination and expression you here employ, the more you increase his despair and affliction. In Hume's example, the goal is to produce pleasure from feelings of sorrow, and the thought is that attempts to affect it by manner of presentation would not only fail, but even heighten the parent's pain. Presumably, similar line of thought applies to insult and mirth. On some occasions, manner can be used to produce mirth, while on others, it may exacerbate the insult. Okay. Let's get this. So, essentially, what I want to do is marry what I think to be the virtue of talking to you with the redirection view, where there's both an indication that what's being employed is some kind of pleasure frame. But there's also a skill-based aspect of it, too, where the delivery of the utterance often causes the utterance to direct their focus on the manner in which it's being presented, rather than on the content. Right. To marry those two things together, you get to do something like the that I want to take place. Right? So in conclusion, I think this, and I'm going to call it the modified redirection. So in conclusion, I think the modified redirection view is a plausible contender, but of course there are still some details to work out. While it is not yet clear on this view how we determine the limits of the sale of the world, what is not yet clear is that we don't have a way to determine the limits of what's sale of the world. So what makes something off limits? Well, given the appeal to redirection, we might start by suggesting that the material be ridiculous enough to cause murder instead of offense. In his assessment of the Ann Coulter roasting, Ian Crouch, who's a writer for The New Yorker, said that the jokes didn't go far enough to be funny. This suggests that the content of the jokes were not outrageous or ridiculous enough to direct attention to the delivery rather than the content. The content of most of the jokes, as Crouch noted, was quite similar to the kinds of vitriolic statements about Coulter that one already finds online. As such, the joke reads a straight-ahead insult, rather than the inept attacks that successful roasting exhibits. Further, I'm skeptical that anything like a universal discourse exists where we can say that something is redirecting in the relevant way for everyone. It's quite possible, even likely, that crowd reactions will be mixed. Some will find material delivered in a non-threatening way, while others in that crowd will not. This will at times make it difficult to determine the success of roasting. Lastly, the very notion of a limit may be transitory and ultimately futile. I believe it was George Carlin who said, I think it's the duty of the comedian to find out where the line is drawn and cross it deliberately. In the end, roasting may be the most direct exercise in which comedians are searching out and deliberately stepping over lines. Sometimes this may be an exercise in challenging problematic norms or enlivening dogmatic. However, challenging norms is baked into our current conceptions of the comedian. In this regard, Carlin calls on comedians to be what Charlie Murphy once referred to as habitual mindset.